This is Network Europe.
Stockholm, Paris, Berlin, Kiev, Ljubljana, Bratislava, Amsterdam, Bucharest,
Welcome to the program. Ahead today, all change at Westminster as Britain's long-standing Prime Minister Tony Blair hands over the reins of power to his partner and rival, Gordon Brown. We profile both men. And talking about changing of the guard, has Poland taken on Denmark or Britain's role as chief Eurosceptic? We go direct to Warsaw. An internet video showing what prosecutors allege is police brutality is causing an outcry in Greece. The Netherlands marks 60 years since the publication of the Diary of Anne Frank, and the French battle with the loss of a much-loved but often maligned facet of everyday life. These stories and more in this edition of Network Europe, a partnership of Europe's leading international broadcasters, now broadcast around the world, throughout Europe and over the internet. At the helm in Stockholm today, I'm Mark Cummins. Great to have you with us. Coming up.
This is the soundtrack of graphic video footage believed to have been recorded on the mobile phone of a senior officer in the main police station at Ammonia Square, an area notorious for drug dealing and petty crime.
Police brutality charges in Greece, but first. It was the coming to fruition of a deal that was reportedly done in a fashionable London restaurant over a decade ago. The deal was an arrangement to hand over the leadership after two terms in government between a young and ambitious Tony Blair and his fellow Labour Party leadership candidate, the equally ambitious Gordon Brown. Now, 10 years after he was elected Prime Minister, Tony Blair handed over the reins of power to the long-waiting Mr. Brown. It was the end of an era for Britain, but also for Europe, where Tony Blair was long held up as the poster boy of political reform. Radio France International's Rosalind Himes in London takes this look back at Tony Blair's legacy and into the future at Britain's new Prime Minister.
Towering beside the Houses of Parliament in London, Big Ben rings out on the 27th of June 2007 as Tony Blair leaves the premiership after a whole decade. And when you ask people in Britain from all walks of life how they will remember Prime Minister Tony Blair, there is one word that just shoots out.
Iraq.
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 The Iraq War.
Iraq.
Iraq. Iraq.
The Iraqi War.
Paul Dooley, a logistics expert, didn't like the way Blair went about it.
He didn't consult the British people. The thing about Iraq is the longer it goes on, the more people just forget that it's going on there. The British people didn't want to be there.
But if Tony Blair made himself unpopular for his last 4 years in power since the invasion of Iraq, that's not the only reason. Even a war veteran has other gripes against Blair.
Well, the economy is definitely improved. The country's richer than it's ever been. But there's a great divide. There's a bigger gap between poor and rich now than there was when he came in.
You're a Labour voter?
I was. That's another thing. There used to be clear blue water between the Conservatives and the Labour. There was no ambiguity about voting. But now, there's no clear water between any of them. So, in a way, he's robbed me of my vote. I don't feel like voting.
Blair the warrior. Blair the peacemaker. That's what he is to Emma McAvinci, from Northern Ireland.
I was 16 when he first came in. He was a very young, vibrant, forward-looking Prime Minister. He was very innovative in his ideas and how he led the country and certainly the things that he did for Northern Ireland. He's second to none.
James Galloway is an accountant in London's West End. His view is that Blair leaves a rich and important legacy.
He's also left a legacy of eradicating global poverty, which until probably 2000-odd, wasn't seriously addressed by the Western nations. I think the relief of debt for the poorer nations is something that 50 years down the line we'll be able to say that is a very serious achievement of his 10 years as Premier. I think also his involvement in the global warming, again forcing the United States to take the matter seriously.
There are many in Britain who voted for Tony Blair, not just once, but twice, or three times. Nana Boateng came from Ghana and settled in Britain many years ago. He works as a chartered accountant in a property firm. He thinks Blair is, over and above all, human.
I think he's a nice guy.
He's tried to do whatever he thinks is best for the country, and I think he's obviously made mistakes in the Iraq war. And not a lot of people would just stand there and say, right, which this is what I believe in, and fight for it. And that's what he did. Now we know what happened, and obviously some of what he said wasn't quite true. But at that time, he thought he was doing the right thing. For me, one of the positive things he's done is he's changed the country and he's become more equal. He's more embracing. He's more of a free marketer, and he's changed the Labour Party. So he's been good for the country and he's been good for the party.
This station is Westminster. Change here for Circle and District Lines. Exit for Westminster Abbey and Houses of Parliament.
I wonder if Britain's new Prime Minister ever goes to work by Tube, London's underground. There are lots of questions being asked in Britain today about Gordon Brown, Tony Blair's successor, and his former Chancellor or Finance Minister. Francis Beckett is a writer and journalist specialising in British Prime Ministers. He answers some of the queries about Brown in a new book published today called Gordon Brown, Past, Present and Future.
Even though Gordon Brown and the previous Prime Minister Tony Blair are members of the same party, they are fundamentally different people with fundamentally different philosophies. Gordon Brown, I think, is a man of the left as it is now in Britain. That's to say, he's not a socialist in any meaningful sense of the word. If you mean by socialist somebody who believes in the power of the state to change things and in public ownership. But he's a socialist if by that you mean that the principal job of government is to narrow the gap between rich and poor and to attempt to abolish poverty. Gordon Brown believes that, and he believes it with all his heart. It comes from his childhood, in a way that Tony Blair never really did. I think what you will find is Britain raising its eyes to the rest of the world instead of being obsessed by the Middle East on the one hand and the United States of America on the other. I think you'll find the Brown government lifting its eyes and looking further afield, looking for alliances wherever he can find them. I think also you'll find for the first time that you have an independent foreign secretary, a foreign secretary who actually has his own input into foreign affairs. None of Blair's foreign secretaries have mattered in the slightest. They've had virtually no input. Blair has effectively been his own foreign secretary.
One person put it to me that Brown has very big boots to fill. The bets are on as to whether he and the new cabinet he's due to name before the end of the week will be able to do that. Rachel Jolly is with the left-wing think tank, the Fabian Society. She says he's likely to try to underline Labour's progress on domestic issues, as well as pursuing development at home and abroad.
There have been some criticism of the Labour Party for not making enough of its social changes, perhaps because it didn't want to be seen as too left-wing, and it needs to own up to being more interested in equalities issues. And I think that Gordon wants to say more about those, and he's made a big play of health and education being massively important to him, and that he's looking for more investment in the health service and more change. Although Labour has invested heavily in the health service, there's still an immense amount of dissatisfaction from the public on what it's actually delivering.
He also talked about making more of an effort on foreign aid, development aid, that kind of thing.
Gordon has had this long history of valuing development aid, international aid in Africa, and something he feels strongly about, but it's obviously going to be a big part of his international policy.
Radio France International's Rosalind Himes with that report. You're listening to Network Europe. Still ahead.
This was the heart, the core of the ghetto. This is the place where it should be.
The cornerstone of a Jewish museum in Warsaw is laid. Well, just as Britain settles into a changing of the guard, Europeans are coming to terms with a change in the tone of discussion in the European Union. Last week's heads of government summit in Brussels to hammer out the content of a new European treaty was characterised, as always, by some very tough bargaining. But a tacit understanding on what can be used as a bargaining ploy in European negotiations was challenged when Poland's Prime Minister Jarosław Kaczyński cited his country's war dead at the hands of Nazi Germany as a reason why he opposed German Chancellor Angela Merkel's proposed new system of majority voting within the Union. In the end, a compromise solution was found, but since the summit, commentators around Europe have been trying to get their heads around what the comments mean for Poland and the EU. Well, I'm joined on the line from Warsaw by managing editor of Polish Radio's external service, Alexander Kropiwnicki. Alexander, what was behind your Prime Minister's comments?
Well, first of all, I have to say that the EU has a huge support in Poland, according to all opinion polls. It is now more popular than the United States in Poland. We are now a part of the EU, and more people feel this way. And, as a matter of fact, the Polish Prime Minister, Jarosław Kaczyński, is very much interested in the EU success as well. He was just expressing, that's my guess, he was just expressing this bitterness, which is still easy to find in the Polish nation. But this is not against the EU. Well, one shouldn't confuse those things. This is about our regret that years ago we lost some great chance. And now we feel the distance between us and more developed Western countries. And now we need generations to reduce the gap.
Could you say that the Prime Minister's comments were directed towards a domestic audience then?
I don't think it has much to do with domestic politics. You know, we are a newcomer in the EU and a pretty important one. That is why we have to fight for our strong position in the EU, following the example of, for instance, Spain, which is so politically correct today, but it wasn't 20 years ago.
How were the Prime Minister's comments reported on at home?
Well, some newspapers criticized the remarks, indeed. Some other newspapers supported the Prime Minister, not necessarily those particular words, but generally his position. I don't think our public opinion has been ready to condemn our Prime Minister's words, because many Poles share his point of view and feel bitterness I mentioned, particularly the old Poles. On the other hand, many other Poles think that our relations with Germany should be more about future, not past.
Now, what about the deal that Poland eventually got at the negotiations in Brussels? How were they reported on in Poland? Was it seen as a success, or was it seen that Poland has backed down?
Those who paid attention, those who followed the process of negotiations, have certainly felt some relief. People in Poland are rather likely to support compromise. But, in my opinion, most of Poles don't find the new treaty the most important European issue. Perhaps they are wrong. I mean, they find European integration important, and they would like our country to play an important role in the EU. But I'm not sure if the treaty itself has been properly sold in Poland. The deal was praised by most of journalists, but some of them are still afraid of growing importance of Germany. Not for today, not for tomorrow, not for next future, but within 10 or 20 years, who knows. This is what Angela Merkel seems to understand well. We've got some bad experience. We have still been traumatized by the experience. And we need decades of good cooperation with Germany to forget it. Also, there are some bad stereotypes about Poland in Germany itself. So it is a long process.
Managing editor of Polish Radio's external service, Alexander Kropiwnicki. You're listening to Network Europe. Now, countries around Europe mark the United Nations International Day in support of victims of torture this week. This year it comes as, in Greece, human rights groups are calling on the police to root out what they call a subculture of violence. This follows the broadcasting of a video on the internet of what prosecutors allege is torture by police. More allegations of police brutality have since emerged, as Deutsche Welle's correspondent in Athens, Malcolm Brabant, reports.
For years, there have been repeated allegations of brutality by Greek police, particularly against immigrants, allegations that have attracted fierce international criticism. But there has never been solid proof until now. This is the soundtrack of graphic video footage, believed to have been recorded on the mobile phone of a senior officer in the main police station at Ammonia Square, an area notorious for drug dealing and petty crime. The video has led to torture charges being levelled against seven policemen. On the face of it, the main perpetrator is a decorated detective sergeant who forces two robbery suspects from Albania and Kazakhstan to hit each other harder. The sergeant's lawyer, Evstathios Karithomatis, claims his client snapped after the two suspects, who were high on drugs, insulted his mother and his family honour.
The regret is that in this case that we saw in the video, he lost the control. He didn't act professionally, he didn't act as a policeman. Even me as a lawyer, after 20 years that I'm practicing as a lawyer in Athens, I had heard nothing about practices of that kind of the Greek police.
Greece's public order minister, Viron Polytheros, has condemned the video as an insult to the nation's civilization, and the main police union has described the incident as an isolated one performed by vultures in uniform. About 1,000 demonstrators are chanting almost into the faces of 100 or so riot police who are protecting Athens' main police headquarters. The protesters believe the video was just the tip of the iceberg. Since it was broadcast, more allegations of brutality have emerged. This is the voice of a young Moldovan housekeeper whose lawyer says I can only identify her as KM. She's wearing a neck brace as a result, so she says, of being badly beaten in the main police headquarters where the demonstration took place. KM says she was beaten up after refusing to help police track down a former boyfriend. She claims that after the assault, officers applied ice to reduce bruising.
They hit me on the head, and in particular a policewoman in plain clothes. She had a very heavy hand and she kept hitting me. At some stage she stopped and then she started again in front of the policeman.
KM was telling her story to Dr. Maria Pinu Kalis, who runs Athens Medical Rehabilitation Center for Torture.
The very tragic thing for me is that one of the most strong actors of this were a lady, a police woman. And they tried to do torture without possibility to be proved. And this is the new dimension of torture. They try to apply torture that they don't leave scars.
The young Moldovan is pressing charges against the police. According to her lawyer, Victoria Banti, their case is helped by evidence from the hospital which treated KM and also from the torture centre.
She had the courage to go on into the criminal procedure, while most of these cases, either the victims do not go into the criminal procedure or they decide to withdraw because they are not legal immigrants. And there is a very problematic situation when we go to the court, since whatever takes place in a police station has witnesses, only the police officers and the victim. Therefore, when we go to the court and we try to prove that all this situation took place in the police station, we have all witnesses against us.
The Greek police are now under greater scrutiny than ever before, and their union is hoping that the scandal will lead to reform of education and behaviour of the men and women who are supposed to uphold law and order.
That was Deutsche Welle's Athens correspondent Malcolm Brabant. You're listening to Network Europe. 60 years ago this week, Anne Frank's diary was published for the first time. The diary of a Jewish girl who went into hiding in Amsterdam during World War II has been translated and published around the world and is widely recognized as a definitive document of the era. To mark the anniversary, the Swiss relatives of the Frank family have transferred their private archives to the Anne Frank Foundation in the Dutch capital. Radio Netherlands Marieke van der Berg asked Anne Frank's cousin Buddy Elias why they decided to bring the archive to Amsterdam.
It has only been found about 2 years ago, and the obvious place where it's the best to be stored is here at the Anne Frank House. I mean, it would have been no good to keep it in our attic or to keep in our house. It must be somewhere where it's well being taken care of when I'm not alive anymore.
Do you know what's in the archives?
Yes, of course. There are many, many letters by all the family members and documents.
Why is it so important that this archive is brought here to Amsterdam?
Well, the story of Anne Frank is important throughout the whole world. It's fantastic that still Anne Frank everywhere means so much. So it is clear that everything connected to the Frank family is important to the world. Mm-hmm. And here in Amsterdam is the best place to keep it.
Doesn't this surprise you that there are so many people interested in the story of Anne Frank, but not only Anne Frank, but her whole family?
Well, it is actually mostly Anne Frank. I mean, in our family, that goes with it. I mean, I get many letters and mails from people that want to know what happened, where I was during the war, for instance, what happened to my family. But but Anne Frank is really the person that shows the more, has the more interest in the world.
Is this a very important day for you?
Yes, it is a very important day for me, yes. Emotional, yes, that is, that's true.
Yeah, what does it mean?
Well, it means to let go of a lot of things that are dear to me. But, I mean, let go does not mean that I lose it. It just means it goes to another place.
It's important that everybody who's interested can learn about it.
Yes, exactly. That's it.
Buddy Elias, a relative of the teenage Holocaust victim Anne Frank, whose diary of the years she spent hiding in Amsterdam is one of the most widely read books in the world. Now another reminder of the Holocaust in Warsaw, where the cornerstone for the Museum of History of Polish Jews was laid in the Polish capital this week. Joanna Neifeld of Polish Radio's External Service was there and filed this report.
The Sound of Music, especially composed for this occasion, opened the groundbreaking ceremony in the heart of what before the war was the Jewish district of Warsaw. It will now be the location of the Museum of Polish Jews, a state-of-the-art center of education in Polish Jewish history and tradition. And there is a lot to educate about, says Shevach Weiss, former Israeli ambassador in Poland.
We're talking about the approximately 1,000 years of Jewish life here in Poland, you know. The developing of Jewish culture, religious groups, religious movements, Hasidim, Misnagdim, Jewish culture, the Yiddish language, our Mamelushin, the language of our mothers. It was here, especially in Poland, the developing of economy, of Jewish talents.
For many of those attending the groundbreaking ceremony, it was an emotional moment.
I've been waiting for this day. The only day I'm waiting for more so is the day of the opening.
It was a very, very exciting event. I've come all the way from the United States to be here to witness this.
Once the museum is built, rich exhibitions will feature 1,000 years of history of coexistence of two cultures on the Polish territory, and the building of the museum has been designed by a Finnish architect, Rainer Mahlamaki, says Jerzy Halberstadt, the director of the museum.
Compact, gentle, outside form, strengthened by dramatic, expressive interior. The core of the museum will be a permanent exhibition, which in 8 galleries will present 8 main chapters in the Jewish history on the Polish soil, starting from Middle Ages to contemporary.
Holocaust survivor Marian Turski says that the location of the museum is very special.
This was the heart, the core of the ghetto. A place where was the Jewish administration, then here were the first shots in time of the Jewish uprising. Not far from here, just 400 yards, is the Umschlagplatz, place of deportation of 300,000 Warsaw citizens of Jewish nationality, to Treblinka, to extermination. This is the place where it should be.
The idea to build a Jewish museum in Warsaw originated with the Jewish Historical Institute and quickly gained support of the Polish authorities and the international Jewish community worldwide. The first donations came from the London-based Polonia Aid Foundation Trust. Zygmunt Rolat of the American Committee of Support for the Polish Jewish History Museum.
President Kaczynski, still as the president of the city of Warsaw, enthusiastically endorsed the program. Now he continues to support it as president. And also, of course, the present mayor, representing the city of Warsaw, donated the land. And they also donated, actually, most of the funds for the building of the museum. And they will also continue to finance the operation of the museum.
Project authors hope that the museum will help clear up misconceptions and stereotypes about the Jewish presence in Poland.
Jews thrived here. They were received here with friendship and even privileges in some cases at the time when Spain and Portugal, for example, was expelling Jews. Children from all over the world, both Jewish and Christian, will be able to learn all about the history of Jews in Poland. And I think that it's a very glorious history of which we can be very, very proud, and which up to now was actually not shown correctly to the vast, vast majority of the young Jewish people coming to Poland, who invariably concentrated on seeing Auschwitz, Treblinka, Majdanek, but very little of where Jews lived and thrived and accomplished so much for so long.
The construction of the museum building begins in March 2008. It is scheduled to be completed by the end of 2009.
Joanna Neifeld from Polish Radio's External Service. And as always, if you'd like to listen to this or any of our programs again, you can by logging on to our website at www.networkeurope.org. You'll find information there on how you can subscribe to our podcast. And a new regular item on the Network Europe website, we travel around Europe to receive a postcard from one of our producers or reporters. This week, Radio Netherlands' Richard Walker gives us a snapshot from Amsterdam's Schiphol Airport on the experience of travelling with a small child in the aftermath of the high-profile kidnapping of Madeleine McCann in Portugal.
I took my daughter Marla home to Brighton on the English south coast at the weekend. We've both got passports, but she has her mother's surname, Costello, rather than mine, which is Walker. It's purely for aesthetic reasons, but suddenly it's become a problem.
That's at our website. That address again, it's www.networkeurope.org, www.networkeurope.org. Now, we love to get feedback on our programs from our listeners. You can send us your comments, suggestions, ideas and criticisms to our email address, contact@networkeurope.org. That address again, contact@networkeurope.org. Now, finally, before we go, a few weeks ago, I asked you to name Europe's six neutral countries. The right answer was, of course, Sweden, Finland, Austria, Switzerland, Liechtenstein, and Ireland. That was Sweden, Finland, Austria, Switzerland, Liechtenstein, and Ireland. Thank you for all your entries. We picked out two from the barrel of winners. So our winners of the Network Europe quiz this month are Tony Finn of Dublin, Ireland, and Hans Werner Lollicke of Nakskov in Denmark. Congratulations, and keep a lookout for Network Europe merchandise coming your way in the next couple of weeks. Well, that's absolutely all we have time for today. This program is a partnership of Radio France International, Radio Sweden, Polish Radio External Service, Deutsche Welle, Radio Netherlands, Radio Romania International, Radio Slovakia, Radio Prague, Radio Ukraine, and Radio Slovenia. Network Europe will be back next week. Until then, on behalf of our pan-European team, this is Mark Cummins in Stockholm. Thanks for joining us. So, jag sov mig genom eviga orens dagar, mörka grenar blev mitt ögas blind, skugga flod. Men segel på min trötta blick, och när jag släpper taget så faller jag i din varma famn.
Som jag